Melting Titanium Session 55, April 27, 2010. And we begin, I don't know, an hour and 9 minutes into it.
You have a household where the mom and the daddies are teetotalers. They're against alcohol or liquor. So it's eliminated. Can't have it, don't look at it, don't smell it, don't even want mouthwash that's got alcohol in it. Then when the child comes along, it gets real entrenched that this is just bad. So what do? They go to college, and then they go from one kegger to the next kegger, trying to find out how bad this bad thing is that it was eliminated from their reality. Then they get to the point where they start liking the taste of gin. Bob, gin don't taste good.
They like it because they think it's bad.
They can't. It's taboo. Then they develop a taste for it. And if that's the case, then they realize that they can do what they want to do, and that's all fine, well, and wonderful. But then they become a crutch sometimes. A crutch that puts them in the capacity to where their body, exactly, grows dependent on the feeling that the libation provides.
Their mind wanted it because it was bad. Then they keep drinking it because they got used to it. And then the mind aspect has been put aside, and now
then they are dependent on it because of the feeling place that getting sloshed does for the individual.
And the feeling place is their memory of the rebellion taboo being sweet?
Nope. The memory place is that when I'm drunk out of my mind, I don't have to worry, think, have a problem. I can be myself. I can take the pressure off. I can just kick back. I don't have to be so focused.
Well, that's different from the band motive.
It's the completion of it, you see.
Somebody's going to taste sweet to them because it's banned, taboo.
Well, it's like boys. They only want to sleep with the girls they can't have.
So that's taboo, and that's sweet if they get it.
And then they get them, and then it's no big deal, and then they want the next one. So then they get on their 15th marriage, they decide that maybe it's just the coochie and not the relationship that does it for them.
And when they decide that, they don't remain married?
When they decide that, then they can be happy with the one that they're having coochie with.
They think it's a woman, but it's just the coochie.
Right. Or what they can't have. Good. Now, the same thing is true with white sugar, complex carbohydrates, gambling, everything that you call an addiction. But now, y'all use that word, y'all as humans, use that word like it's a terrible thing. But you're addicted to oxygen, and that's not so bad.
All desire is what you can't have, or because it's taboo, that's the beginning of desire?
No. That's the beginning of what you're calling anomalous addiction.
So you start off feeling you want something that you can't have. Then when you have it, it tastes bad, but you think it's taboo, so you like it. Then you like it. And then it switches to feeling you're responsible or you don't have responsibilities. Is that connected to the original taboo thing?
And it's back to the flip side. Because remember the duality in conversation. That's the second part.
Well, it's a duality, right?
And then don't forget, now we'll use another one that you'll like. You're going to like this one. It's like the Lucky Box you used to in the old-timey movies, you know, back when you went to the movies, Bob?
Mm-hmm.
And you could have them jujubes and the goobers and raisinets and all those chocolate and popcorn with lots of butter. Back when you went to the BU Theater, if somebody was having relations, they had to have one foot on the floor. And they're engaging in coitus with their clothes on. People had pajamas on more than people wear to parties. They'd wear more pajamas than they had wear to church.
Wait, you're saying people went to movies in their pajamas?
No, Bob, we're talking about people fucking on the TV in the role in the movie.
Mm.
They wore more clothes to bed than most people would wear in church.
Mm.
Okay. So now what's happened is your looky box has exposed every dynamic. There's not one portion inside, outside of the body that hadn't been so crammed down your throat. So now the pleasing embrace or playing or engaging with a breast only becomes the comparative of what you've seen that breasts are supposed to look like. And that's why everybody's running around with their saline and their augmentations and adjusting their breasts, because they want to make themselves look like what the looky box said their breasts were supposed to look like. Okay? And that's the problem. Well, it's not a problem. Pump it up. We don't care. It makes no difference to us. But that's why. Not saying there's nothing wrong with any of it. We're just saying that's what you used.
No, you said that's why. What was the why?
The way the TV box shows you.
The chemical body is imitating the TV imagery.
Trying to, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a problem if you don't fit the status quo of what the looky box says.
We know all that stuff, so...
Okay, so then go.
When you were talking about the movies, I thought you meant the audience was screwing in the theater.
Well, pay attention, Bob. We know all that.
It would have been meant that.
Right now. Come on. Let's go.
It would have been good if you meant that, but you didn't. You meant the images on the movie.
I thought that's what you meant, too.
Yeah. Okay, so what were we talking about? Oh, taboo. That's an interesting point. Two conversations. You go from trying to get a desire, you know, a taboo, then it switches over to another dimension, realm, of trying to feel free and not responsible and getting rid of your worries. So that's a switch. It's like a discontinuity. That taboo motive in the beginning, it becomes another motive. Do you agree to that?
And it's a completion, certainly. That's what
you said
that analogy.
Okay. Can we sort of relate the two? Maybe there's a similarity, a connection, rather than discontinuity?
There are. Yes.
The connection, they wanted to get drunk to remember when they were carefree. And how does that connect to, I guess, carefree and being able to do whatever you want, even taboo stuff, right?
Now, when you're drunk, you can't do what you want to do, but it sort of limbers you up to the point that you're so limber that you are not thinking about the things you can't do. And we don't have a problem with that neither. Just have all you want.
You can't do.
If you go to
sleep. So the can't do, the first part is you have a desire for what you can't do, and then you go and do it.
Then once you do it, then it ain't always cracked up to be.
And then you get into this thing of, I don't want to think about what I can't do. Oh, yeah, I don't want to think about that move. So I get into a state of mind through the drink where I can't remember what I can't do.
It doesn't have to be drink. Drink is a lot of sugar. It can be an inordinate attraction to processed sugars.
Trying to quench what you can't do. Then you want to forget about the thinking of what you can't do.
Mm-hmm.
That's the second phase.
And if you can't, then it becomes a problem, and then you become addicted to whatever that is.
You start off trying to acquire what you've been told not to acquire.
Right.
Then that means nothing. So then you don't want to think about what's taboo. So you take drink to forget about what's taboo and just enjoy where you're at.
That can be just as easily done with bread or gin or crack or crank or Snicker bars or sex or gambling or anything.
So that's what happens, Carol. A child is programmed by what they can't do. They're given rules. Then when they become an adult, they want to forget about the child condition and not have to worry about what they can't do. So they acquire grave states of not thinking what they can't do. They want to get rid of what they thought of as a child. Hey, Carol, what did you learn from the first hour?
All kinds of things that are not allowed to be spoken on melting titanium. It was all in code to me for a reason. So I'm not going to say it out loud. So just stop it. When someone says no to you, don't you know what no means?
No.
No, exactly. I know that.
Emphatically speaking, yes. What part of no do you not understand, Bob? None of it. I don't understand any of no. I never got no. No is like, do we have no? No. See? There you go. What you going to do? What you going to know? Yeah. Okay, so back to Bob. That's what we're talking about here. This is the Bob Hour. So what if, Bob?
Someone told me today, who was it? James.
Short-term memory.
Yeah, James.
Good.
He got a message from a friend that he met in Peru who was in the military, an engineer in the U.S. military, and he's over in Baghdad. And he said, something strange is happening at the Baghdad airport. The Iraqi government took it over, and he said, something big's about to blow. So we will now take advantage of our ion radar. And what is going on in Baghdad this weekend or today or tomorrow?
Kind of already happened. Okay, first of all, you got the Shiites and the Sunnis. None of those necessarily are the Taliban. It's engagement they're trying to control by sanctions that have been put on them so they can't have the nuclear blow-it-up bombing bombs.
You're saying the Americans make sure the Iraqis don't get bombs.
The Iraqis didn't even know there was such a thing as a damn bomb until the U.S. told them that that's what they can't have. Taboo, isn't it? We don't want your country, but we want your oil. We're going to give you guns so you can shoot yourself as long as we can have your oil. We're going to set this jihad, which came from America, in the Taliban, which came from America, because they had to have them to be the terror of the terrorists. If you take the terror out of the terrorists, they'd just be hit. Okay? So they set the terror by saying you can't have terror, and they taught them how to be terrorists so they could terrorize. And now the Americans are running around in abject terror. So now it's coming to a little questionless head. It's got to get squeezed a little bit so it can pop and let all that, since you're enjoying your little snack, we'll talk about corruption and the weeping of that sebaceous cyst of the pus inside of it. That'll be good. That's a pictorial for your sensory perception.
While I eat.
As you enjoy your snack. Then what happens is this comes to a head, because what they're trying to limit is all traffic in and out, because they're pushing that country, well, some in that country, is pushing against the sanctions that the U.S. is going to put on their geography. It's in response to the potential sanctions that's coming.
Doesn't Iraq already have a lot of sanctions?
Not like what's coming.
So the American government's going to put new sanctions on them.
Well, it ain't just Americans, all of them. That's the whole point, is that they're all going to get sanctioned.
But they're going to bully up Iraq.
Yeah, as long as it doesn't infringe on the U.S. getting the oil. Really, it's fine, of course. But see, America already owns those leases anyway, so it really doesn't make a difference.
Doesn't make a difference about what?
How OPEC affects the oil flow and what that has to do with Iraq and Iran all piled up together. I mean, you got to remember they got rid of the Ayatollah Khomeini and got Saddam Hussein. So who sponsored that little coup?
Some elements in the Iraqi government are anticipating the sanctions. Why did they take over the airport? How does that help them?
Well, it helps them because they control who goes in and who goes out and who doesn't.
So how are the Americans going to respond to that?
This one shoots that one, and that one shoots at this one, and then, you know, blah, 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 blah.
So they took over the airport to control the traffic, and that controls who comes in, and that includes sanctioned officers coming in. They won't be able to get in.
See, there's not like a million airports in that country. That would be like saying, okay, we're going to put sanctions on the U.S. We're going to take over JFK Airport. Well, America would say, we'll be shit. Nobody flies out of JFK anyway. We go out of LaGuardia or any of the other 10,000 other airports. It's no big deal. But over there, it's not like you got 50 airports to choose from. So you start closing off at that level. Then the little secret places that they can fly into noticeable if air traffic is grounded from that geographic country.
Who flies in secretly? The Americans?
Yes.
So they can find out where those spots are.
Well, because they'll be the only thing flying.
The Iraqis will find out where the secret spots are, right?
Well, they know. There's Air Force bases there already.
They can't shut that down.
Oh, they can shoot it down when it's time to get there, though.
Basically, you're saying Iraqi has put themselves in war position against the international forces.
War. They don't want to fight a war. They want to be a terrorist. Not all of them, a handful of them.
They want to be a terrorist.
Death to America, remember?
So no dramatic thing.
No dramatic thing. There is no problem in Russia, especially in Chernobyl. Yeah, no, there's no big deal. It is large as far as tangential dismay. Because look, Bob, Ben Bernanke was on today telling you that you're going to fix and have to pay more taxes because somebody's going to have to start dealing with this couple of $1 trillion worth of debt. They're going to start cutting the Medicare and the Social Security benefits because of the debt. Well, by God, there's going to be a war. Somebody's going to war. And they'd much rather that be over in the land of Nod than in the senior citizens in this in the U.S.
There has to be a war because of the Bernanke statement.
Yeah, you start crossing up with the senior citizens of the U.S., and you ain't seen a war. Them little grandmas, they'll run Congress. They'll run you out.
So they move the war to Iraq, and that distracts the Americans from their war?
Yeah. Because everybody's worried about the war. They're not worried about having to cut their benefit.
Carolyn was wondering what happened in Poland in the transfer with the parallel worlds.
What would you like to know, Carolyn?
What's happening now with those world-to-world transfers of that material? Is it still ongoing?
It is still ongoing.
Was it some sort of power move?
Or a king group said enough. Circle of wagons is now going to work it out. And so, therefore, it gets safely till the storm passes over. When the clouds shall be no more, they move it into a quiet arena for use in another day.
Was it getting too well known?
No, hot and too much sugar for a diamond.
Well, hot in terms of danger or hot in that it was getting too well known?
Yes and yes.
So the Polish government were the janitors of that operation, so they had to be stopped because they were screwing up or being exploited by others.
They didn't have to be stopped. They got their asses blown up. Are
they going to make a new government there?
Yeah, or not. Yeah, but logically they do that. It's like when you cut down a hardwood tree. If you cut it down, another one comes right out of the same stump. So it's not a problem.
I think there were some shady dealings going on through there. And the 14 group was not for that, so they stopped it, right?
They just moved it till the storm passes over, when the clouds shall be no more.
Okay. They removed the Polish government, who were the mediators between the worlds, and they put their own people in, or put it somewhere else.
Oh, we say putting. Not put yet, they're putting. They don't have a new government yet.
There was somebody doing some inter-world exchange of materials, and the 418 group, they didn't like how that was happening.
No, they moved it to another world so it could safely be used another day.
And they had to kill the government to do that?
No, they didn't even do that part. That just had to crash it all down because it was getting too hot.
They had to crash something down. Now, we're going on in this world and move it to another world. Was the crashing of it down related to the deaths of the Polish governor?
No.
Oh, that's what we're connecting.
We are.
Why was the Polish government removed?
You haven't made it clear. I haven't got a clue.
Why was the Polish government removed, Ion?
because they were engaging in business that was becoming more and more and more uncontrollable.
Was that business involved with parallel world transfer materials?
Yes, okay, we established that. No, we established that. So
but next minute we won't, so...
No, stop second-guessing everything.
Second-guess, Russ, Bobby.
Okay. So the Polish government was doing stuff, and the 14 group decided that the Polish government was mishandling that responsibility of moving materials between worlds. The Polish government was moving materials between worlds on their own, correct? And so they knew about the parallel worlds. They knew how to do it. So then the 14 group put a stop of that transfer, correct?
Sure.
The 14 group then took the transfer position somewhere else.
Very good.
So the Polish government was removed in that process. It sounds like the murder of the Polish government was related to the transfer issue.
No, it was not related to the transfer issue. The transfer issue happened before the plane went down, and that was an outcome. You're not going to get that the transition caused the government to go down. The step was moved because the way it was being handled was fixing to get too hot. Did we mention that?
So the Polish government was removed because they were the ones who were creating a situation that was getting too hot.
Yes. What else in the 5 hours did you want to say this for?
My friend APIC, who appeared on the March 24th tailgate with his scientist friend who were into yeast studies. Remember the yeast guy?
Indeed.
He had a friend, older mentor, who died. So then they had a memorial a week ago on Monday where all the gangs that were influenced by this guy came out and they wanted to paint the wall, graffiti paint the wall, and it was quite chaotic. But then it got interrupted by a white dove, I think, that got caught in the awning of the building near the wall. And they didn't know how the bird got in there. And they tried to get it out, but eventually it escaped on its own through another hole they weren't aware of. And they all watched it fly off in the sky. Was that white dove the dead person, Joe Moe, that they were doing a memorial on?
No.
What was that white dove?
It was a beast of your planet. Joe Schmo, the last thing he would have wanted was that whole big scene foolishness over his memory. I mean, kind of put a pretty nasty swage on all of it.
Yeah, how did that happen?
And so the beast said, enough, and so the distraction stopped them from fighting about what graffiti they was going to fight about on the wall to honor the memory of someone who supposedly connected them in life. It's kind of like, oh, well, we're going to paint a wall for President Abraham Lincoln because he brought the North and the South together. Now, wait a minute, you know? That's not quite the way it goes.
So the beasts, which are not physical, did Joe Schmo's bidding by distracting everybody?
Of course, and get it out of their mind because it got them a little, what you call, a little bit of woo-woo. That woo-woo distracted the distraction. The woo-woo distracted the distraction.
Did the bird enter through a normal procedure in the awning? Because it looked like how could it fit in, but it had a way to get in. It was not woo-woo about it getting in.
Oh, yes, no, it was the woo-woo that he would choose to be there.
But non-physical helped Joe, so Joe indirectly had that happen. So
Joe was non-physical at that point, Bob.
He helped orchestrate that.
Well, of course.
What do people up there want to know about me?
Why in the hell are you so tangled up with this 22 business? We want to know right now in detail.
Well, can you name me the person and where they live who's asking that question?
Do you want their name straight out? Because it's I, Sheila.
Is Sheila listening?
She wants to know about you and 22, Bob. Okay, this is how it hey, on point. This is about Bob, and that's what it's going to be about, Bob. So go, Bob.
Okay, in
in November 1981, I was asked to organize Marshall McLuhan's archives by his widow and friends. So that required me going to the bank building's upper floor and looking at all the old boxes and going through and kind of inventorying what's in them and organizing them. So I'm going through each box and organizing the contents and then number the box one, then do the second box two. I'd done 21, wasn't thinking about the numbers, just making sure it's 21. Okay, next box is going to be 22. Probably wasn't even thinking, just started doing the next box, and I find a folder in there. And it says Bob Dobbs, McLuhan Archivist. It has my name and the folder, and it says McLuhan Archivist. I didn't know I was a McLuhan Archivist, so I pulled out the file folder, and I looked at it, and it was a copy of the bibliography of McLuhan's works, which was given to me by McLuhan's secretary, Mark Stewart, who I was a friend of, and Carolyn was a friend of. It was a copy of a copy of a copy sort of thing. I remembered, oh yeah, one day in 1970-79, McLuhan's assistant asked me to make a copy of my copy of the bibliography because they wanted to know what I had ticked off and acquired on my own personal search for materials of McLuhan's history. So that was what was in the folder, and they called me McLuhan Archivist. Never was official, but that's what they called me. So that was interesting. So I finished organizing the box and marked 22 on it. Didn't mean anything to me. Then I went to 23 and 24, probably did a few more boxes, and then it was time to go home, and Mrs. McLuhan drove me home. And I got out of the car. This is November into December 81, and I walk up the front door of my home, and it's got a big 22 on it. And I go, oh yeah, we live at 22 Kenwood. And my name was in box 22. I thought about that. 22. And I might have noticed another pattern, like maybe our phone number added up to 22. I always added up numbers, so that was easy. And so now I was very happy that to do McLuhan's archive, and the number 22 showed up as significant, because I was in box 22, I lived at 22, and our marriage date added up to 22. 6-9-70, June 9th, 1970. 6 and 9 is 15, and 7 is 22. So I mentioned this to a friend, Ian Arlett, a Toronto poet. I just mentioned this 22, very little information, just about as a pattern showing up. Then I forgot about it, and 6 months later, Ian Arlett came over to 22 Kenwood, and he handed me a little notebook with all kinds of drawings and sketches and newspaper articles, and he said, you know, you mentioned this thing about 22. Well, I started looking at 22 here and there, and it was everywhere in the news and everywhere, so it became his synchronicity symbol. Huge inventory of all the 22s, and he said, Bob, this is driving me crazy. I don't know why 22 shows up. That's it. I don't want to do this anymore. I'm not looking at 22 anymore. It's a strange mystery pattern. But then I really noticed, after he reinforced it, I started noticing 22 in the news all through the 80s, and anybody who interacted with me always had a 22 in their being, in their system, in their life, and that is how 22 became significant. It was interesting. This is all happening in Toronto, which is like 2-run-2, Toronto. You make a pun on the name Toronto. 2-run-2. When we got to New York City in 1993, I started noticing the number 14. Actually, in December 89, 14 women were murdered in Montreal at one of the universities there. Some guy didn't like women feminist students, so he shot 14 of them, and I noted the number 14, and then for the next couple of years, 1991-92, I noticed that 14 was showing up a little more, like the fact that the Queen had $14 billion or something. These little facts showing up, like 22 would show up in the 80s. So when I got to New York and found out New York was about 14 miles long, I said, the 90s are 14, and 2-run-2 was 22 in the 80s. 22, 80s, 14 in the 90s. After 2000, I noticed we lived at 44 Fordham Street, 4 and 4 is 8, and I started noting that 44 showed up, Bin Laden was 44, 9-1-1 happened, his guru was 44, other 44s were happening, we lived at 44 Fordham, so I decided 8 was the number for this past decade. So you go from 22 to 14 to 8, and I'm sure you've had enough of this answer. Sheila, did you like that, Sheila?
Yeah, Bob, it was delicious, but you didn't answer the question. You just told a bunch of gobbledygook. What is the thing about the numbers?
Oh, okay. As I would talk about 22 to people, when I got on the radio and was broadcasting information about
Lynn LaRouche, Mae Brussel, Dr. Beter, Marshall McLuhan, James Joyce, Herbert W. Armstrong, Finding His Way, Cosmic Awareness, Garrett Deep.
22 of those?
No, no, there were 9 of these people. And I decided the 10th one was me dealing with all of them. I dealt with all of them. I wasn't any one of them. I dealt with all of them. And so I decided to call myself Club 22.
When you say dealt with them, when you were the 10th one, how'd you get 22 out of that?
There was 9 specialties, subjects, memes that I played with on the radio. Me handling them all was a separate entity in itself, and I called that separate entity me, and my friends like Carolyn and Ian and people who knew about the 22 pattern, we called ourselves Club 22. 22 was a major number, so I'm Club 22. I later found out that the Windsor Arms Hotel in Toronto had a little bar called Club 22. Interesting. I didn't know that at the time. So anyways, when people ask me why 22, I would explain it this way. 22 was the essence of metaphor. A is to B as C is to D. A simile is where things are like themselves. That is like an orange. It is sort of equal. It's similar, a simile. But a metaphor is a ratio. It's not exactly like it. It is as. So something is to something else. So Carolyn Dean was the Wayne Gretzky of hockey. Carolyn was a rookie in 79 going into medicine, like Wayne Gretzky was a rookie going into hockey. So Carolyn was outstanding in Toronto medicine as Wayne Gretzky was outstanding in hockey. That's a metaphor. A is to B, as C is to D.
That adds up to 9 or 22.
I don't add it up. That's a good point. I didn't add it up. I wanted to say you got 2 letters on one side, A is to B, and 2 letters on the other side, C is to D. So it's just the peculiarity. There's 2 items on one side of a metaphor and 2 on the other. That, to me, was 22. So 22 was the essence of the analogical proportions of consciousness.
So consciousness is just a blob.
I eventually asked the Evergreens, channeling through Michael Blake Reed, why did 22 show up most often in media reports? Why is it a favorite number, it seemed to be, in the 80s? And the Evergreens said, because editors look at all the material that they're editing, and 22 gives them a sense of balance. It's a balanced-looking number. So they tend, when there's a news item and they don't know exactly how many people died, they'll say 22 because it's a balanced number. So that kind of reinforced my image of 22 as a metaphor, as an analogy of proportions of Bob, and balance.
Enough of that. Stuart wants to know.
Well, was Sheila happy with that?
She lost you after the second sentence, but yes.
Jesus. Yeah, I made an effort to be clear. And come on, people. If you're going to ask me questions, pay attention. Okay, Stuart.
Well, he forgot.
They got intimidated by Bob's rule. Come on, Stuart. Wimps. If you're going to talk about me and interrogate me, get your act together. Come on. I don't waste time talking about myself if it's going to be lost in lazy memories or lack of attention. So, Sheila, ask me another question, Sheila, and redeem yourself.
There's just this twirling of Omaha, Nebraska, A to B to C to D. 22 that don't add up to 22,
all
numbers, something.
Okay, I'll supplement this.
And something that...
Fine, I'll supplement my answer with this.
No, we're asking the question. You need to answer it.
A is to B. A, 1 is 3.
A
and B
is
C three. Is T. No, C no, is 3. No, of course, no, 7. No, well, A is to B is 1 is 2. That's 3. And then
wait,
C is 4.
Eight, and you do the cubed root of 8. That's 2. And 2 minus 2 is naught. So therefore, naught from naught is naught. Good. Okay, that's good. Now, what does that mean? That's the question.
I would not make those computations, but let me tell you about 22. As I talked about 22...
You did calculate numbers, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. But we'll get to that. But fine. I want to help people.
They don't need your help. They're just interested.
I found out that 22 is the number of letters in the Hebrew alphabet. It's the master number in the tarot. There's a lot of mystical, esoterical tradition around the number 22.
Mother Tarot, we love her.
Most people thought that 22 was a master number. And when I said I was Club 22, they thought that I was saying that I was a master. And I said, no, I did not mean that. That's interesting. But I'm saying 22 is balance, is metaphor, is ratios. That's what it meant to me, and it shows up. And the 90s were a different decade, and they went 14. You want to know what 114 means? Okay, how about this? take the digit 1 or the numeral 1 and the numeral 4. They're sitting beside each other. You don't think of adding up items, 14 items. You just look at the shape of the number, a 1 and a 4, like you look at the 2 and the 2. The 1 indicates the unity caused by the Android meme or the internet culture. Technologically, we're unified in the same membrane. But 4 is the 22 collapsed into a 4, and you have quadriphenia. So because we're unified, people accentuate their eccentricities and their differences to have a little creation of wealth, like emphatically create difference. And so the 4 represents the quadriphenia that's floating around the 1 that the internet creates. So that's 1 and 4.
Jenny, anything else about you, Bob?
No, I won't go into that stuff. So I'll just take more questions about me.
They just want to know what's next. You got this far, is this it, or is we, what's now?
That's a good question. Everybody's saying, they're jamming people, key people are saying, Bob, this ion thing is interesting, but I'm really looking forward to what's next. And I tell them, there ain't nothing next. This ion is it. We're creating a new civilization. We'll stand back and watch the miracle-working power of Dobbstown.
Oh, good.
And ever accomplishing Dobbstown. So we're going to create a new civilization. That's what's next. It'll be a new kind of civilization, not even in your traditional images of civilization. It might even be invisible. It might be a kind of communicable Shangri-La.
Okay, now when will this be?
It's starting now. That's why this is a very special show tonight. We have actually realized a new level.